episode 133. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Welcome to today's live stream. It is Sunday. I am right here in Puerto Rico. Came in from St. Bart's. Got to renew my driver's license here. A lot of good stuff. Been looking at some real estate, taking care of a lot of business here. So it's all good. It's very sunny today, although they've got these restrictions, these lockdown restrictions here, really draconian, especially on Sundays. So I'm just kind of hanging out in my Airbnb. But that gives me a great opportunity to sit down and answer some fantastic questions. So guys, before we dive in, I'd suggest checking out Rebel Capitalist Pro, and that is the awesome online investment forum that I have with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It has their research. We have threads. We have questions. We have live streams. It's everything you need to take your investing to the next level, especially if you like buying things when they're cheap and selling them when they're expensive. You can go to georgegammon.com/pro. But let's dive into the questions. Paul is asking, many countries are C or B negative ratings, turning to C. Your thoughts on all these countries heading toward not being able to pay their debts? Yeah, I mean, I don't really like bonds that much, to be honest with you. There might be some countries that, I know Lynn's got a great argument for Russian bonds. I talked to Jim Rogers about that. I know other people that don't like that play, to say the least. But there is their balance sheet looks good, that's for sure. But I definitely prefer, especially in a time when all these countries are in debt, and usually the best way or the path of least resistance for a country would be inflation. I much prefer equities compared to bonds. But I don't know that they'll not be able to pay their debt. I mean, it really depends on if they can print their own currency or not. So it's really a matter of what countries you're talking about as far as not being able to pay. Now, paying back with currency units that have the same value as far as purchasing power as the currency units they borrowed in the first place, that's a different story, right? So bottom line is be careful with bonds, where interest rates are at a 5,000-year low. So that means that bond prices are at a 5,000-year high. And we like to buy things when they're cheap and sell them when they're expensive. And guys, if you do have a question, make sure you start with the word question in capital letters. It really helps me find them in the chat stream. Aussie is asking, I just watched through your chat with Mr. Wolf. Great stuff. I'd be interested in your opinion on how his idea of democratic enterprise model would work in practice. Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, Richard was nice enough to come on the show. Really, really a nice guy. I mean, even when we were talking, when we weren't recording, very, very cordial, obviously a bright guy. And I really respect him and appreciate him for coming on the show. And hopefully we can have him on again when I can ask a few more questions and have some rebuttals. But it's an interesting idea to have this, to have entities owned by employees. That's basically what he's saying, to where you didn't have an individual that started the business and owned the business. I think the best, and it may sound corny, but it's just my honest answer. The best rebuttal I would have for someone who thought that would work is to manage a 100-seat call center for 1 month and then get back to me on how well you think the employees could manage a business without an employer or without the entrepreneur, without the person that started the business, that risked their capital, that built the business from the ground up. I've owned call centers and I've owned a lot of businesses. I'm just using that as one example. And I don't know. I don't know that that would work too well. And anyone that owns a business currently, whether it's a small business or mid-sized business, just ask yourself, what would happen to your business if you just left for 6 months and came back? I don't know. My guess is productivity would go down substantially. And in my experience, one of the things that what I've seen separates a very successful entrepreneur from one who is maybe not so successful is someone's ability to manage people and to be a true leader. And if that's delegated to a group of people, I just don't know that it would work. And it's ironic too, because I'm someone that completely believes in decentralization as far as the government. Obviously, I'm a libertarian and I don't like centralized power. But what's weird is at a small scale, it's superior from a standpoint of productivity at a small scale. It's very weird. And I don't know where the line is. It's like, if you've got 100 people and they're all trying to work in an environment, let's go back to a call center. It's going to be much, much better if you've got one person or two people that are calling the shots and playing that leadership role. You can't have too many chiefs. You got to have some Indians. But on the same token, I would argue that if an entire country is managed by one dictator, then, you know, I think what it would boil down to is competition. Because, see, in a free market, you've got businesses. So if you did have that person that was in charge of that call center, and if they did a poor job, those employees could go work for a different call center. And most likely, the call center with better management would put the other call center out of business. And when you take it up to the state, in the states, see, I think that's why the states were so such a good idea, because you could just go from one, assuming that the federal government was just very, very limited in the scope of their power. Because if you didn't like what was going on in one state, you say, you know what, pound sand, I'm going somewhere else. There's competition for your intellect. There's competition for your capital. There's competition for the skills that you bring to the table. But when you've got a huge federal government, the difference between the states becomes less and less. And so I think that's probably where I draw the line. I'm just thinking it through in my head. But that's really kind of the short rebuttal that I would have if I just had 30 seconds to anyone that felt as though there would be superior efficiencies and productivities if employees ran the show. I would just suggest that they manage a 100-seat call center for a couple months and then get back to me. Question, George, I heard you make a lot of money working at the Federal Reserve, but the pay sucks. Yeah, I mean, I think you're trying, that's kind of a joke, because I get a comment every once in a while where people think that I'm some sort of plant from the man or from the Fed or from who knows what nefarious group. And if that wasn't the case, then there's no way I could grow a YouTube channel to 175,000 subscribers within a year or something like that. I have to be an insider somehow. And maybe that's what you're referring to. Yeah, Peter, I am. Peter asks, are you not concerned about the gold confiscation or confiscation through a precious metal sales tax? Yeah, I 100% am. I mean, my level of concern wouldn't deter me currently from owning precious metals, from owning physical. As far as concern, yeah, for sure. It's just a matter of how do you try to mitigate that risk to the greatest of your ability. And I think you've got to have political diversification. Obviously, from a physical standpoint, I think you should have a second passport and you should be have a second bank account. You should have a plan B, but I would definitely do the same thing for the the physical precious metals that I owned. As far as the metals tax, I mean, yeah, I'm not just concerned about a metals tax directly, but just with capital gains, in the sense that if the nominal price of the precious metal just goes up with the rate of inflation, you still have what the IRS considers a capital gain, even though your purchasing power has not increased. Therefore, if you were to sell the precious metal, then you would have a taxable event, and what you were able to put in your pocket, you would have less purchasing power than the original amount you took out of your pocket to buy the precious metal in the first place. So I would probably add that to the couple concerns that you have, Peter. But the short answer is yes, I'm definitely concerned. Yeah, I get it. AM is saying, in a worker-owned co-op, all workers have interest in the continuation of the business. Your need to understand how a co-op works, the structure is different. Yeah, I get it. I get it. You know what? Let's do this. Let's look at this YouTube channel, the George Gammon YouTube channel. Obviously, I could not produce the videos that I produce without the help of some fantastic people. Let's just look at my editors as an example. So yes, there's definitely a need for other people to produce the amount of content that I produce. And I could not have built this channel without those people. But the question then becomes, is who's more important in the dynamic here, right? So let's just say that I stopped doing these videos, and it just I said, okay, employees, you got it. I'm going to give this YouTube channel to you. You go ahead and take the ball and run with it. What do you think would happen to the YouTube channel, right? So, and I know it's an extreme example because the YouTube channel is basically built around the George Gammon brand, if you want to look at it that way. But it's very applicable to any other business, in that I could find another editor, right? Not that I'd want to, because I have the best editors, I think, in the world, and they're fantastic. And I consider them almost family by now. But if in a pinch, if everyone quit, let's say, I could find other employees, and the George Gammon YouTube channel would go on, I can assure you. But without George Gammon, I don't know that the George Gammon YouTube channel survives. And it was the exact same thing when I did the TV show. Even if I wasn't featured in the TV show that I did, without George Gammon, that TV show never happens, ever. It wouldn't even have been created. But B, it wouldn't have been put on air, and we wouldn't have had the 13 episodes. There's just no way. And anyone that works for me and that was there, I mean, ask Angie, ask Joaquin, ask Sebastian, ask any of them that were there, they'd say the exact same thing. So, yeah, I get it. I mean, it is the employees are extraordinarily important. The stuff won't get done without them. But if you're trying to ask a question as to, if a business can function at the same level or a higher level without the person that started the business, without the entrepreneur, I think that might work on paper, but in practice, I don't think you get too far with that. Hey, Arthur, what's going on, buddy? Good to see you. Arthur Martinez is here. Thanks for being on the live stream. We'll see you on the Rebel Capitalist Pro live stream here in a bit. Okay, so Joseph is asking, does your view of the Fed change based on QE possibly being deflationary? I would strongly suggest watching my last whiteboard video. It came out Friday night. And QE being deflationary, it depends on a lot of factors. And I don't know that I would go so far as to say QE is deflationary. At surface level. I mean, I think there's an argument that if this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens and this happens, like four or five different steps, then possibly it could be deflationary. But I think a lot of things would have to line up. If you just look at it at surface level, the Fed exchange doing an asset swap, basically, whether they're doing an asset swap with cash that's on the balance sheet of the commercial banks, the primary dealers, or it's an asset swap with just bank reserves. I don't know that it really is ever going to be a net negative, because even if it's an asset swap, treasuries for bank reserves, by the time the let's call it the digital units of measurement go into the TGA and then get spent back out to the economy, the TGA is creating an additional deposit. So even if there was a reduction in the money supply initially by the primary dealer bank buying the treasury or by the Fed doing a QE in the first place, then there would be a simultaneous increase in the let's call it the, I want to get away from calling M2, and I want to get away from broad money. I want to start using the term deposits in the commercial banking system, because that's really what I think we need to get hyper-focused on. So even if there was a reduction in the deposits in the commercial banking system by the act of QE, the act of the Treasury spending the money would increase the commercial deposits by the same amount. So at surface level, without taking it to four or five steps, the least that's going to happen is you're going to have a net wash. And if they're using bank reserves to buy the treasuries and then they're replacing them with bank reserves, so there's not a decrease in the overall capacity or the overall currency units that are chasing goods and services, then it's definitely going to be inflationary. So I don't think the choice is it inflationary or deflationary? I think the choice is it a wash or is it inflationary? Again, and I want to be very, very clear, at surface level, I know Brent and Steve have a fantastic argument for if this happens, then this happens, then this happens. You know, you're restricting the amount of credit that's being issued by the commercial banking system. Therefore, on net balance, it would be deflationary. I totally get that argument. I respect it. And, you know, those guys are probably a hell of a lot smarter than I am. And they could be right. And I'm not saying they're wrong. But at just at a very basic, the first step, I believe that if you look at the way it works with the balance sheets of the Fed and the commercial banking system, it's either a push or it's inflationary. Here's a pretty good question. How do you know when to fire someone? It's a skill set that you have to learn. When I first started, I didn't know. I didn't, you know, back when I was started off as an entrepreneur, when I got out of college, I didn't have that skill and I had to learn it. And what I would do is I would probably hire people too quickly, just because it was kind of an inconvenience, or it's just kind of a you know, okay, great, I got to see another person and another person, another person. Let's just hire someone and let's just get this thing done, right? Let's get going here. So due to a lack of patience, I would probably hire someone too quickly, and then I would take too long to fire them. Because I would keep trying to make excuses, or I say, you know, let's work with more and more and more and more. What I found in my old age is, and after dealing with quite literally thousands of employees, is it's better to spend a little bit more time up front picking the right person, and then fire people a lot faster. It's better for both parties, because if they're not going to be a good fit, you know, they're wasting their time learning your process and you're wasting your time teaching it to them. So that said, there is a balance between you want to give someone enough slack. I mean, you don't want to fire them the first minute or the first hour. But if someone is there, I would say a week, and especially if you've got a lot of experience reading people, and which is a learned skill through being an employer, you're going to know in a week or two, listen, that you're just getting a bad vibe from this person. And it's just, you can just see this train wreck happening, and it's better just to cut the cord. So I would say, first and foremost, if someone is just showing up late at the beginning, like if the first day or two they're showing up late, I'd fire them, because it's the first day or two. Right. If they show up in the first week and they've somehow got a bad attitude, or they're trying to argue with you I've had that where I'm trying to, you know, the very first or second day when I'm trying to teach someone something, like how I do QuickBooks as an example, they'll sit there and argue with me on how I'm doing it wrong. I'm like, dude, listen, you know, I don't want to go into why I'm doing it this way. And I didn't hire you to critique my the way I set up my chart of accounts. I just need you to do the data entry. And so now if someone's worked with you for 6 months and you have a rapport with that person and they come to you and say, hey, listen, George, you know, in all honesty, I think we could be doing QuickBooks better if we did X, Y, and Z. I mean, that's way different. I'm just talking about like the first day or two, if they're doing this, it's like, that's like a red flag. That's a big red flag. So I think it's kind of different based on the person. Once I get a certain number of red flags, especially in the first week or two, that's when I know it's time to cut the cord. Oh, and you know, one other thing that I would add is never hire someone you can't fire. That was always my motto. Never hire someone you can't fire. So what that means is don't hire your mom. Don't hire your best friend from college or something like that, right? Just don't hire someone you can't fire.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Okay, question. Jerry is asking, are you buying the dip on companies you've done fundamentals and eyeballing? No, I'm not. I mean, no, I don't. You know, I really take the stance of Jim Rogers, and I don't buy. I honestly, and hopefully my memory serves me right, but since 2012, since I got into investing and I retired, I've only bought stocks, I think, three times, maybe four, and I've never sold. So, you know, and the only times I've bought is just when we are in extreme conditions. So I bought, you know, Cypress when the market went down by 99% and they were doing the bail-in. I bought in March when just the whole world was coming to an end. Those are usually the times I step in and buy. I'm not really someone who just is constantly super, super active. You know what I mean? It's just, remember what Jim Rogers said in the Market Wizards books, and I talked to him about this. You just sit there and wait and do nothing. That's the best investment strategy. Do nothing. And then just wait for a big pile of money to sit in the corner and then just go pick it up. And usually I don't see a big money pile of money sitting in the corner every week or every quarter. Generally, it's every, whatever, 3 or 4 years. And then you take action. So now, that's not to say that there aren't some things that are cheap as far as speculations. And it's not to say that I'm not always out there looking for cheap real estate, because that I am. But I have a level of expertise in real estate that far, far, far exceeds my level of expertise in buying stocks. That's why I started a Rebel Capitalist Pro, because I want to increase my skill set. I want to learn. I want to get better. And I know that by working with Lynn and Chris, that I'm going to get better a lot faster, and I'm going to decrease the size of my learning curve. So, that's kind of how I see it. That's an interesting question. Rigo is asking, in your opinion, how do we end the Fed? I mean, I think there's things that we can do as far as online and just in spreading the word as to why the Fed and more so inflation, or maybe, I mean, it's kind of a chicken and egg there, I guess, but it's really inflation is what we don't want. And it's this constant inflation that compounds over 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years, and that completely changes the dynamic of the economy and the participants in the marketplace. That's what we don't want. But I guess you could say that if without the Fed, you wouldn't have that. So I think the more we can spread that message, the better. And I'm trying to do my part on YouTube, obviously. In fact, I got my hat right here. Whoops, there it is. But I don't know. I mean, realistically, are we the people going to be able to end the Fed? I mean, I don't know what the probability. I would say the probability is pretty low. But I think what would end the Fed is a complete loss in confidence of fiat currency. And I think that could happen. And so I don't know if it's going to be kind of this organic type of grassroots approach to ending the Fed, or it would be they end themselves with their own policies. I think that's probably has a higher chance of coming to fruition, that the Fed's own policies end them before we do. Okay, Bernard is asking to get us out of this mess, debt versus inflation, earn less while fully employed. Debt versus inflation, earn less while fully employed. Producing companies charge more while workers spend less because make less. Where is the new money coming from? Well, Bernard, if you look at Lynn's work, she shows that over the last few months, the average income of the American has gone up, not down. So there's in some areas, not all areas, of course, but in some areas they're spending more, not less. And so I think that you're associating employment with the ability to spend money. And rightfully so. But unfortunately, we live in a world where those two are no longer tied at the hip, where unemployment doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have the ability to buy the same amount of goods and services. So what it does mean is that if we don't have employment, if fewer people are working, then fewer goods and services are being produced. And if fewer goods and services are being produced and you have the same amount of demand for certain things, and I understand that doesn't include like high-end vehicles or something like that, or things that you really need debt to buy. But if we're just talking about groceries, if we're just talking about the stuff you buy on a daily basis, then I think you've got the same demand for those types of goods while the production of those types of goods is decreasing. And so I think one thing I'd like to leave you with is it doesn't necessarily mean that there has to be new money. It's just that the rate of new money, you're in a race, right? You're in a race between currency units and goods and services. So even if the currency units are going down, if the goods and services are going down at a faster rate, then on net balance, there's an increase of currency units relative to the amount of goods and services, even if the aggregate total of currency units is decreasing. So that I think you got to look at both sides of the equation. Okay, Firepower Johan is asking, if Fed and central bank was not Keynesian and say had a target of 0% inflation instead of 2%, would you like central bank to continue? The best way I can answer this question is it goes back to Warren Buffett's quote on, you know, what was his quote? It's something to the effect that when you're trying to invest in a business, make sure you invest in one that even a dummy could run, because sooner or later, a dummy will be running it. I mean, I'm probably getting it wrong there, but it was something to that effect. And that's how I see our monetary system. Is I would prefer a monetary system that didn't require people being smart or competent or having a thorough understanding of economics to run, because sooner or later there will be one or multiple people in succession that will be running it that that aren't making good decisions. So therefore, I would like to just not have that power centralized. It's just like the government, same thing. And a lot of people get all uppity about lobbyists and whatnot. I totally agree. But is it the problem that we have lobbyists, or is it the problem that the federal government just has too much power? Because if the federal government didn't have as much power, would lobbyists exist? Like, what corporation would pay a lobbyist $1 million to go to Washington when they couldn't get any benefit from it? And so I think really we have to look at the system, and if it was decentralized, then it doesn't matter if we get the dummy running it. It doesn't matter if we get an authoritarian running it. It doesn't matter if we elect the wrong guy or gal, because they can't do much damage. So I'd prefer to see the Fed in that type of role where, well, in what type of role? Just in the role where they didn't exist. Or, you know what I'd like to see the Fed do? I'd like to see them stick with producing data. Just keep the Fred website and just be in charge of making charts and like data. And don't be in charge of anything. Just be my research assistant. And they're very good at that. Just continue being my research assistant. But just leave the interest rates and the money supply to the marketplace. Sam is asking, I see UK has largest or second largest current account deficit, also second highest holder of US treasuries, and famously sold much of its gold reserves at the bottom of the market. Time to leave. I don't know that alone would be my first priority in the decision-making process as to whether to leave or stay. Obviously you got to consider family, and it's sometimes there's no easy decisions. What I found in life is there, like Thomas Sowell says, not only in economics but in your personal life, a lot of times there are no solutions, there are only alternatives. And you know, I'm learning that a lot more as I get older. And I won't go off on a tangent, but the bottom line is there's a lot that goes into whether or not to stay or leave. And I think it's different for every person and every person's situation. If it were just a matter of what's on paper and from making the best economic decision, or for it depends on your job. I'm assuming that you've got maybe a flexible job, or a job where you can be mobile, and in which case I don't think that anywhere in the developed world is where you'd want to be for the next 10 or 20 years. I think that you're going to see a lot of the capital move east. Doesn't necessarily mean China. It means other places like that. And I think that it could potentially move towards companies that have a better balance sheet and companies that are more friendly to capital, and to where they might not be great now, but the trajectory and the trend line is going in the right direction, where most of the countries in the West, I would argue, the trend line is, although they may be far superior now, if you just take a snapshot of what's going on there and what's going on in the world, I would argue that their trend line is going in the wrong direction. And I think if you want to have a lot more tailwind than headwind when it comes to your financial position, then you'd be better off looking at somewhere where the trend line is going in the right direction. And quite ironically, most of the countries where it's going in the right direction are countries that probably now most people wouldn't even consider living in. And they wouldn't even have considered traveling there maybe 5 or 10 years ago. But it just goes back to, like, it's like it's like a great investment. Every investment that I've made in my life where I've made a ton of money is one that everyone told me I was crazy to do it. Every investment where I've lost money, which fortunately has only been one or two, is it's where everyone around me told me it was a great idea. So there could be something to that as far as where you can go to be the most prosperous over the next two decades. Question, what is my update on PR housing? You mentioned it on Twitter. Yeah, and there's another one, just like Arthur. Lama like a Yama, hopefully I'm getting it right. I appreciate you being here, my friend, and I can't wait to see you guys on the live stream, the Rebel Capitals Pro live stream at 2 o'clock Eastern. But PR is an interesting case. It's a tough nut to crack, and you've got a lot of cross currents. As of right now, I don't know that I would suggest real estate here. Stay tuned. My opinion on that could change in the next week or two. I think that as far as Act 20 and 22, that would depend on your personal situation. And I think there's also a lot of cross currents there. There's a lot of tailwinds. There's a lot of headwinds. And I'll probably have a better opinion at the end of next week when I'm able to meet with a lot of the local professionals here. But the bottom line is, unfortunately, especially for Americans right now, because we're taxed on our citizenship as opposed to our residency, there are not a lot of great solutions. And there are only alternatives. There are no solutions. But right now, even the alternatives that we have are not, there's no perfect alternative. That's for sure, as an American. And I'm going through this process myself. And so obviously I'll let you guys know what I think and what I'm doing personally, because most of you are pretty much in the same boat that I'm in. And the fact that you want to increase your financial well-being, you want to increase your personal freedom, your liberties, and you want to go to a place where they're just going to leave you alone and you can just focus on, increasing your business or being more productive and enjoying your family. And just, I think we all are in the same boat there. And so, I don't know that Puerto Rico is a panacea. In fact, it's not a panacea. That's what I'm trying to say. But it could be better than every other alternative that you have right now as an American. So I think just stay tuned for more information on that. Yeah, so Hector has a good question. If banks don't have reserve requirements anymore to issue loans, why would they sell their T-bills to the Fed? There's no point in growing their reserve account at the Fed. Yeah, you've got to kind of shift your focus, Hector, from looking at the from the reserves to the capital ratios and the capital requirements they have, the banks have to issue those loans. So that's kind of the what we've moved from as a banking system that was regulated is the right word, but it was kept in check by reserve requirements. And now the focus has gone from reserve requirements to capital requirements. So that's kind of the, let's see, let me make sure I'm answering. Why would they sell their T-bills? Yeah, so that's why they're doing that. Okay, question, do I think it's a good time to buy assets, long-term portfolio commodities? Yeah. I mean, commodities are cheap. Commodities are at an all-time low relative to financial assets. So I, for most commodities, especially if you're trying to buy a producer that isn't paying you to own them, then that would be a speculation. And for me, this isn't advice to anyone, but just what I do is I don't like to have the speculative side of my portfolio with more than maybe 10%, something like that. So I think you've got to take that into consideration. The one nice thing about commodities is that is when you're investing in a company that deals with a hard asset, it's I think, especially if it's like a, well, maybe not like a trust, but I think it's a lot harder. You see, a commodity will never go to zero. Most likely. So it always has some sort of intrinsic value, where if you have a company like Kodak, I mean, they don't, I mean, retrospect or hindsight is 2020, but they don't have anything that's tangible. They don't have unless they owned a bunch of real estate or something like that. So I like hard assets because they just don't go to zero. And obviously that's one of the main reasons why I like gold and I see it as insurance. But, and I think in commodities, they're very cyclical. And I think the cycles are easier to predict than individual stocks. I could be wrong, but just from what I'm learning and how I process it in my head. So anyway, my point there, without going off on a tangent, is yeah, I think commodities are cheap right now. And if you're looking at them as far as a speculation, there's some asymmetry. And if you've got a 10, 20 year time horizon, now would be a good time to consider making a purchase. At least that's what I'm doing. And I can't give you personal advice, but that's what I'm doing for myself.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, oil went to negative 40, guys, but you got to keep in mind that was just in the United States. It's not like, and I talked to Jim about that, Jim Rogers. It's not like you could go buy a barrel of oil for, and they'd pay you. You know, you couldn't go to the gas station. Gas wasn't negative prices. So, and at the world oil market, it never got negative. That was just right here in the United States. And what, it was for a day or something. So, all right. Question, do you consider Austin, Texas, a cyclical or linear market, looking to buy a single family home, $500,000 on 30-year fixed, but inflation adjusted prices seem expensive? Thoughts? I'd have to look at the price per square foot on that, Bob. And then I'd want to look at the your RV ratio. I mean, could you rent that out? Let's see, looking into a single family home, $500,000. I mean, could you rent that out for $5,000 a month? Probably. I'm guessing maybe not. But if you can get like a, but now we got to kind of readjust our thinking there. I mean, I talked to Hartman the other day. And he's like, yeah, you kind of have to ratchet it down from 1% because interest rates are so low that your positive cash flow is still the same. And even with a lower upfront RV ratio, and at the end of the day, it's all about positive cash flow. And the RV ratios is kind of a quick broad stroke to figure out what the cash flow might be. But now, I mean, if you can get like a 2.8 or 2.5% 30-year, you might be able to have a great positive cash flow if you're getting $4,000 a month for the property. Now, I'm not saying it's a rental, but that's how I look at any property that I'd look to purchase, as far as asking myself if it's cheap, if it's expensive. So I try to look at the inflation adjusted prices when you look at a historic trend line, but then I'd also look at the cost of the per square foot. So in Texas, I'm guessing you could build, and this is just the construction. We're not talking about the permits. We're not talking about the land or the cost of construction. Probably, I'm guessing 150, maybe 175 a square foot, depending on your finishes. I mean, if you got awesome finishes, that could go up to 300. If you've got just super, super low grade, like apartment finishes, you might be able to squeeze out 150, something like that. So it really depends there. But I'd look at the cost of construction, the RV ratio relative to the interest rate, your positive cash flow. And then I'd look at the historic trend line. And then I'd try to go off that. But remember, with real estate, it's always about location. It's always about being in a great neighborhood. It's always about being in a great school district. If you're looking at a long-term hold on the asset, which I would be doing if I was in, if I ever buy real estate, even when I buy a flip, by the way, I always analyze it as though I was going to keep it for 10 years, even if I'm going to flip it. So just kind of FYI there. Okay. How do I think the Great Reset will affect consumer debt? I think it really depends on whether your debt is adjustable or whether it's fixed. I think you got to start there, because a Great Reset, in my mind, if you're talking about like Klaus and his cronies, that video I did with the World Economic Forum, in my opinion, that would be wildly inflationary, because you got a lot of supply destruction and they're talking about printing a boatload of money and getting it right into the real economy. And let me be very clear there, going back to my last whiteboard video, I'm not just talking about printing money. I'm talking about increasing the deposits in the commercial banking system and decreasing the amount of goods and services. That's what I'm talking about specifically. So I don't see how that wouldn't increase inflation, therefore increase interest rates. Now you could say, well, the Fed will come in and peg the yield curve. Maybe not. I don't know if they have the ability to do that. If you really get down into the nitty gritty, maybe they do. But I don't know that I'd bet on that, because it's way too much. It's just too in the air. And so bottom line is, if you've got consumer debt that's it's adjustable rate, I would, that's not a good thing. And if you've got consumer debt that's fixed, I think it's a little bit better. But to be clear, I don't know that I like any consumer debt. And I know this isn't really your question, but I don't like consumer debt at all. Now, I'm assuming that you're considering consumer debt with the word consumption. You're using it to consume and not to like buy a rental property or something. But if you're talking about just to consume, to buy clothes, to buy food, to buy something that depreciates in value, I don't like that at all. So that's the one thing I agree with Dave Ramsey. Alden Snyder debate. So I'm interviewing Lynn and Jeff tomorrow. It's not a debate. It's kind of a meeting of the minds, where I'm going to have them. It's not going to be a live stream. I'm going to record it. It's going to be an episode of the Rebel Capitalist Show. But I'm going to get, Jeff has never met Lynn and he's never talked to her. And he's not that, according to my conversations with Jeff, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I don't know that he's as familiar with Lynn's work as most of us are. And so that's why I went to him and said, hey, you know, Jeff, I think it would be fantastic if you could just sit down and talk to Lynn about macro for an hour. I think that would just blow people's minds and they'd learn a lot. Not as a debate going back and forth, but just as two of the smartest people on the planet, in my opinion, just sitting down and not only the smartest, but the most well-researched, and just talking about what's going on with QE and with repo and with the euro dollar market and with stocks and with bonds, with the dollar, with interest rates. It's something as a fan of both of them that I'm really looking forward to. And we're doing that tomorrow. So that should be up on the channel maybe Friday, something like that. Best countries to live in for the next 20 years, in my opinion. Well, I think, I mean, again, it goes back to what your personal priorities are. Some people prioritize weather, like me. I do not like cold weather. Other people prioritize other things. So it's tough for me to say this is the best and this is the worst. But as far as just from an economic standpoint, I would look at countries that don't really have this narrative of Marxism or socialism. And if you look at the riots and the looting and whatnot in the United States, regardless of the reason or anything, if you look at what then I shouldn't lump them all together, but from what I've seen, the majority of those people who are passionate about going out there and protesting, they have an affinity for Marxism and socialism. And so if you've got a country that's becoming more and more Marxist and more socialist, and I hate to use those, I don't know how to use those words, because I don't want to dismiss. I interviewed Richard Wolff, and that was a lot of fun. And it was a real neat conversation for me to understand another person's point of view that really had a passion for freedom of speech and freedom of ideas, and has a and understands the value of a diversity of ideas. And so, you know, it's tough because I don't want to sit there and say a Marxist in a kind of a disparaging way, because I know some like Marxists, and I think Richard's, you know, even to his own admission, he kind of says that just to kind of get people excited. So, but I think Richard, if he was really, you know, pinned to it, would consider himself more of a democratic, like decentralized socialist. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you get my point. So I don't want to just cast off this whole group of people in a disparaging way, because there's, I'm sure, a lot that although I might not agree with their ideas and their opinions, we definitely agree on the fact that there needs to be diversity of ideas, and there needs to be freedom of speech. And regardless of how much you disagree with someone, you need to allow them to speak their mind. Words are not violence. I will never, ever accept that. And so anyway, I'm going off on a tangent there. So I just hopefully you guys get what I'm trying to say. But I would, as far as the countries, I would look at countries. Let me say it this way. Let me say it the opposite way. I think that's a little more, a better way to say it, is that I would look at countries who are trending more towards free market capitalism. And if you can find a country, regardless of where it is today, and it might not be a nice place to live, or you might see it as more authoritarian, but if you see they're making progress in the right direction towards a more free market, then I don't know that I just get up and move there right away, but I'd keep it on the radar. Like I just like a stocks, right? You have a watch list. I do the exact same thing with countries. So as an example, I was talking to Chris McIntosh the other night, he has a family member that lives in the Middle East, and I won't go into specific countries or anything, but this place in the Middle East has, over the last couple years, considered, and there's a strong push toward it, towards legalizing casinos and gambling, like Las Vegas. That's, to me, and you may hate gambling, or you may not, from a moral standpoint, you might not like it, but to me, that's like, all right, cool, great. We've actually got a country out there that might not be a bastion of free market capitalism right now, but at least there's like a trend kind of moving in that direction. And I also, he made a great point where you have a lot of countries that were just devastated by this socialist approach, kind of the Eastern Bloc of Europe. And he said, you know, in his opinion, he was saying he thinks that that narrative would not go as far because people remember. They have parents that lived through that. And they're like, no, we don't just know about this centralized power or a loss of free market capitalism. We don't know about it just from a textbook. We know about it from living it. And I think in those types of countries, it's going to be a lot harder for this anti-free market narrative and private property to actually take hold. And so I would start looking at places like that. You know, Georgia is some place that that my buddy Andrew Henderson with Nomad Capitalist has talked about extensively. And I know that's kind of on Chris's radar right now. So I think there's some neat things going on there. And he was telling me that that you can start a business in like 15 minutes. Like they literally have a drive-through set up with the local municipal government or whatever, like in Tbilisi, where their little government office or whatever, it's like a Burger King or like a McDonald's where they have like a drive-through thing and you can fill out, you can download all your paperwork to start a business, fill it out, and then just take it right through the drive-through and just drop it off to the gal or the guy there working at the drive-through and bam, you got a business. You're ready to go. So that's what I like to see. That's the free market. That's let's make it as easy as possible for entrepreneurs to go out there and start businesses, compete with one another, and try to produce better and better goods and services at lower and lower prices. Let's do anything we can to promote that. And so I would start looking at countries who are explicitly going in that direction. All right, guys, I appreciate it. Let me do some shout outs here. And I've got to eat some lunch and get off to the live stream in Rebel Capitalist Pro. So guys, again, as a reminder, if you haven't checked out Rebel Capitalist Pro, definitely do so. I know my marketing guy, Gene, has got a promotion going where you can try a week of Rebel Capitalist Pro for $1. It's a fantastic deal. So check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. And then you can join me over on the live stream. And let's see, this week I've got a live stream, I believe, with Chris. Yeah, because Lynn was last week and Lynn is every other week. And so probably this week's going to be Chris. But anyway, you can check out the forum over there. It's amazing. And also in the forum, what we're doing is we're taking the live streams and I'm having the editors break them down by question. So you can search like gold as an example in the forum, and all of the questions that we've answered in the live streams on gold will all pop up. So we're doing a lot of stuff over there to create more and more content to not only help you guys with the research side of it with Lynn and Chris, but also the learning side of it. And I'm trying to get some time here to do some specific like tutorial videos and whatnot for Rebel Capitalist Pro. But anyway, you guys get it. Check it out, georgegammon.com/pro. Now, let me go ahead and do some shout outs to the people that are awesome enough and cool enough to stay to the end of the live stream. First and foremost, hypertension is cool. Thank you very much. So let me hit the new comments. So go to the bottom. We've got AO. Thank you, John Jay. Arthur Martinez, what's up, buddy? We'll see you in the live stream here in about an hour. Eric, Kim M is always here. Thank you, Kim. Good to see you. Rigo, Isaac, Eric Carlson, Identity Block, Joe Dub, Jimmy Harris, Aaron, John, Mikey's Economics, Oriole, Klaus, Karpfen, or cool. Excuse me, Klaus or Klaus. Is it Klaus? Maybe it's Klaus. Cool Laos is here. I'm sorry for getting that wrong. All right. Isaac, Edinal, Varying Viewpoint. John, Hario, Sunshine Girl, Charlotte, Prouse. I'm sure I'm butchering that. Sorry, Charlotte. Mike, Stephen, Joe, Jim, Felisa. Oh, one more thing too, guys. I totally forgot. I'm going to Vegas Friday. So when I'm in Vegas, I'll probably be there for about 3 weeks visiting my mom. I might do a meetup. I announced that on Twitter the other day. So if you're not following me on Twitter, make sure you do so, because if I do a meetup out there where we just go to like a local bar and grab some beers and just talk about just whatever, talk about macro, talk about investing, real estate, second passports, Puerto Rico, just whatever. You guys can meet me at a local bar there and we can have a good time. So, but I'll put that out on Twitter, maybe a live stream. So if you're not following me on Twitter, definitely do so, but kind of stay tuned for the announcement on maybe doing a meetup in Vegas. All right, guys, thanks for everything. And I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.